This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Dr. Gilbert Welch is trained to help people, to cure them, and to prevent them from getting sick in the first place. But he argues that the medical system we've set up in the United States encourages people to get too much medical care, to be tested for diseases they're not at high risk of getting, to be subjected to treatments they don't need, and to be made to worry about illnesses they won't ever get. He says medical care is not well correlated with good health, so more medicine doesn't mean better health. In fact, he says sometimes it's just the opposite. Dr. Welch has written a new book laying out his argument. It's called Less Medicine, More Health. Dr. Welch joins us today to discuss it. Welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Jane.
You know, it seems like our medical system does rest on this premise that the more connected you are to the healthcare system through good insurance, regular doctor's visits, the ability to have all the tests you need, the more connected you are, the better your health is going to be. But you argue that generally speaking, going to the doctor more often, getting more tests, it's not going to lead to a better health outcome. Why not?
Well, medical care in and of itself is a relatively weak determinant of a population's health. Other things are much more important, income, employment, diet, lifestyle, and so forth. Medical care can be very important for people who are acutely ill and injured and can produce a lot of benefit. But for people who are currently well, it's hard for us to make people who are well much better. And it isn't that hard for us to do something that upsets the balance and makes them somewhat worse. And a lot of doctors are worried about the problems created by too much medical care. In fact, a recent survey suggested that nearly half of primary care physicians believe their patients received too much care. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is sort of to communicate the nuances that medical care can do a lot of good in selected settings, but it can also do harms in others. And I wanted to make these kind of nuances more accessible to the general public.
Explain what you mean by you can't make a healthy person much healthier, but you can do some pretty big damage. Because again, the message that we keep getting is you may be healthy now, but if you don't take certain steps, you could be sick later.
Well, in general, when you go to a physician, there's almost an assumption or there's a great pressure for physicians to do something. And the reality is all the things that we do have some side effects. All of our interventions pose some harm. They may be medication side effects, surgical complications, even death. And it's really important that this kind of intervention may be very useful in someone who faces an immediate risk of a big problem. But for most of us, we don't face huge risks of immediate problems, and yet we will have the immediate downside of the intervention. And that's the balance that it really matters, at what point that you are really at a high enough risk to warrant some intervention.
So I'm going to ask you again, because I love what you're saying, but I just to really hit this home.
Sure.
Why isn't more healthcare, though, correlated with better health? You'd think, if you could afford it just to have a physician on call living with you all the time, maybe telling me what to eat, suggesting, if you go for a run on that trail, you're probably going to twist your ankle because it's mud season. And not only that, but those potato chips, you're going to get heart disease, your arteries are getting clogged up. And why don't I just run this test to see what kind of clogging you have now? Why isn't that better correlated with good health?
Well, the reality is most of the things people can do who are well to stay healthy are things they need to do on their own. If you go and enter the medical care system, there'll be a pressure to actually receive treatments or testing or referrals to specialists, all of which can start in a haphazard process that lead to more invasive interventions that actually do you harm.
So let's say my blood pressure is right on the edge.
If I don't do anything,
but maybe think about trying to make my diet better and exercise, that's a healthy choice. But are you saying if I go to the doctor, I'm more likely to receive medication for that condition that I might not actually need?
Absolutely. And this blood pressure is a perfect example of the nuance. People who have very, very high blood pressure stand to benefit a lot from intervention to lower that blood pressure. But most people don't have really, really high blood pressure. A lot of people have small elevations in blood pressure, what we call small elevations of blood pressure. And increasingly, there's been a pressure actually on physicians to treat those abnormalities. Well, the reality is one of the side effects of blood pressure treatment is to take someone's blood pressure too low, and that can start a host of other problems, the most obvious of which is people can fall. This is particularly true in the elderly, where recent research just in the last 2 months have shown that people that are on two or more blood pressure medications, elderly people on two or more blood pressure medications with normal blood pressure actually face a higher risk of death. And they also face a higher decline in their cognitive ability. Well, that's really not that surprising. It's not good to have your blood pressure be made too low. And more doctors are recognizing the sort of the what I call the U-shaped curve. You know, it's about finding the sweet spot. But right now, a lot of the forces are lined up for us to be too aggressive.
We're talking today with Dr. Gil Welch about his assertion that more testing, more medicine, more intervention is not the answer to better health. We're going to look at some of the assumptions that he says are wrong about our current system and what he thinks works better. And listeners, if you have a question, if you want to agree or challenge him or ask a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dr. Welch, before we get into some of our listener questions, I can imagine some people listening who never go to the doctor and are now saying, fabulous, I knew I was fine. That can't exactly be what you mean.
Well, I'm sure there's some Vermonters who have a understandable reticence about seeing the doctor. And I want to be clear that if you're acutely ill and injured, I encourage you to see the doctor. And as you get older, I think it's important to have a relationship with an individual, a physician that understands your preferences and how you want to approach the end of life. But I do think we've oversold the idea, particularly the idea of the annual checkup. I mean, that's crazy. What evidence there is suggests it doesn't help people, and it can start a whole cascade of events that puts people where they don't want to be. So again, it's about finding the balance, finding that sweet spot.
So you don't think people need to go in yearly for that annual blood pressure checkup, check in with their doctor, or just see how things are going?
I think the blood pressure is the one thing where I would say that's something people should know their blood pressure. That doesn't necessarily require going to a physician's office. What I'm most worried about is the annual checkup that becomes a concerted effort to try to find things wrong with patients. That's not in their interest. The reality is we all harbor abnormalities, and increasingly doctors can find them in our tests, imaging and chemical and now genetics. We're able to find something wrong in just about everybody.
And why isn't that good if you're finding something wrong?
Well, let me show you the poster child for the problem. And the poster child for the problem is in South Korea, where ultrasound screening of the thyroid was initiated about 10-15 years ago. And they've had a 15-fold increase in thyroid cancer incidence, a 15-fold increase in thyroid cancer surgery. There's been no change in thyroid cancer mortality. This is all about finding small papillary thyroid cancers that were never destined to bother patients, but they have suffered from the treatments that have been prescribed.
And I guess that's the key, is that it's not necessarily that finding cancer is bad, but if it's not going to affect the mortality rate and, in fact, may lower your quality of life, that's the problem.
Well, and the problem is once we find things and label things as abnormalities, that begins to put very strong pressures for actions, a set of haphazard actions that may lead people to be harmed in the process. It's never purposeful. It's never purposeful. It's just a side effect of once an abnormality is identified, there's great pressure to act on it.
We got a note from Leon in Plainfield who says, how do I know whether a test is really relevant? And how can I go against the medical establishment and say, I don't want a particular test, but still continue the consultation?
Well, I think the first thing is to impress upon people the importance of symptoms. It's a very big difference between people who feel well, seeking care, which is something I would discourage. I mean, this is when you're well, this is not the time to seek care. And seeking care when you're acutely sick, have a new problem, so forth. That's a very different set of conditions. But if you feel you're presenting with some sort of symptom or a problem and you feel you're being overly tested, you can always ask the question, what are we really looking for? That helps cue the physician that you're interested in a considered decision, and what are we going to do about it if we find it? And I think getting a little bit ahead of testing, and more of the medical community is trying to think this way, is to think a couple steps down the line. Why are we doing the test? What are we going to do differently given a set of results?
Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. We're talking to Dr. Gil Welch. His new book is called Less Medicine, More Health. Dean's on the line from Milton. Hi, Dean. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. I guess the concern that I have is that how much looking over the shoulders are doctors doing, thinking about potential malpractice if they miss something or don't respond in accordance with accepted procedures, practices?
Yeah, Dean, thanks for the call. Dr. Welch?
Yeah, Dean, those are good questions. You're really touching on two issues. One is the legal climate, and of course, this is one of the sort of standard explanations for physicians. You know, why do they do too much? It's because they're worried about lawyers. But you're also pointing up another issue, which is not wanting to deviate from so-called standard practice. I mean, I remember as a medical student, anytime I asked a question about why we were really doing something and there was no good answer, the answer usually would be it's the standard of care. And in fact, that's one of the things that I and others are hoping to change what those standards of care are now, because our defaults are to tend to be towards aggressive action. So those are two factors that are driving some of this. It's a fear of litigation and a drive towards standard practices, not wanting to look too different. But there are others, of course. There's a strong economic incentive on the part of the system, and the system may used to be largely doctors who were being paid fee-for-service. That's beginning to change, but our hospitals are still paid fee-for-service, so they need to generate – they want to generate more revenue, and we'll have productivity measures for physicians that encourage them to do things. And then all the pharmaceutical device manufacturers, they have a strong interest in expanding the number of people treated with things or tested with things. So there's a strong underlying economic incentive that always drives medical care to more.
While you're talking about the system, we got a note from Dave who says, the reason why people want to catch problems early is that when you get acutely ill, it can take too long to get treatment. Dave says, I had a fifth-degree separated shoulder years ago, and I was living with it. I was told that if it started getting too painful, I would be able to get reconstructive surgery. But when it finally got so painful that I couldn't take it, the doctors still made me wait months before having surgery. I was totally bedridden for 2 months while waiting.
Yeah, that's a sad story, and I understand the concern. And ironically, I was just out in Los Angeles talking to doctors in a healthcare system in Long Beach, and ironically, the doctors felt they didn't have the time to see the acutely ill patients because their clinics were so filled with routine checkups. And this is an irony of the current system as we've expanded into well populations and caring for people who actually are not sick. Ironically, it can distract us from those that most need our services, those that are acutely ill, acutely in pain, and actively suffering.
So where does this focus on preventive care fit in then? You know, we do keep not only hearing the message to us as individuals to take steps to keep ourselves healthy, but we see more of a push in the way medicine is being paid for and being billed to work towards preventive care so that we're not seeing those very expensive and, you know, in many cases, very damaging acute conditions that people find themselves
right.
in.
Right. There's all this push to wellness. And I think we have to deconstruct preventive care into two very distinct buckets. One is health promotion activities. Those are things about improving the food you eat and encouraging more movement and all the basic guidelines on living a healthy life. We need to separate that kind of preventive activity from the early detection activity. And the early detection is looking hard for things to be wrong and testing people and trying to find early abnormalities. The problem with the early abnormality side, this has been totally oversold. Its benefits have been exaggerated and its downsides have been minimized or ignored. The downside of the process is whenever we look early for forms of disease, we find a lot more people have early forms of disease. We don't know which ones are going to be important, so we tend to treat everybody. That means we're treating some people who are never destined to develop the disease. And in oncology, this has been sort of described as the barnyard pen of cancers, and there are three animals in the barnyard pen. They're the birds, the rabbits, and the turtles. And the birds, the idea of early detection is try to fence these animals in. But the birds are already gone. They've already flown away. They represent the fastest growing cancers, the cancers that have already spread by the time they're detectable. The rabbits are hopping around, and if you build enough fences, you can catch the rabbits, and that's where screening would arguably have its best effect. And then there are the turtles, and those are the cancers that aren't going anywhere anyway. And screening is really good at finding turtles, and the more we become engaged with early detection, we recognize that there are more turtles out there. And the problem is, again, the doctors don't know which ones are going to be important, so they tend to treat them all, and none of us would want to be treated for a cancer that was never going to bother us. But it's part of the deal of early detection, and that's what makes early detection such a tricky balance and one that I'm afraid we've stepped too far down the road on.
Well, and you know, you're speaking sort of globally here looking at the system, but I'm sure you get people who call in as individuals who say early detection saved my life.
Absolutely. And this is unfortunately one of the most misleading pieces of information the public gets, and that's the so-called survivor stories, people who had an early cancer found, they've been treated, and they're doing well. And the presumption is that this is someone who has benefited from the process, when in fact it's actually more likely this represents a harm of the process, someone who was identified unnecessarily and received treatment unnecessarily. And so ironically, the more overdiagnosis, the more turtles that a screening test finds, the more, quote, survivors there are, the more people who attribute their life to the test, the more likely other people have heard a survivor story, and the more popular the test becomes. And so ironically, tests that are most likely to cause overdiagnosis become the most popular tests. And again, this is exactly what's happened in South Korea, where now thyroid cancer is the most common cancer in South Korea because of screening. And it's led literally about 40,000 people a year to have their thyroid removed unnecessarily.
We're talking today with Dr. Gilbert Welch about his assertion that more testing doesn't necessarily lead to better health. He's written a book about it. It's called Less Medicine, More Health. And he makes the argument for less medicine and better outcomes. If you want to agree, if you want to challenge him, if you have a question for Dr. Welch, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also carry on the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about how he sees his message being received, how he's targeting it towards not just patients, but the medical community. What do doctors need to know about this, and how are they reacting? And what it would look like if his prescriptions were followed. Stay with us here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are talking with Dr. Gil Welch from Dartmouth Medical School. His new book is called Less Medicine, More Health. We often hear it's better to be safe than sorry, but safe could mean not getting that test. Maybe you'll be sorry if you do. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts or ask Dr. Welch a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Peter, calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. My comment is that, and I'm not a doctor, that I really feel like I benefit from yearly checkups. It establishes, for one thing, a baseline with my primary care physician, and as well some productive conversations about lifestyle, lifestyle changes. So it seems to me that the argument is trying to, yearly checkups is to warn us against bad doctors rather than educating physicians and eliminating it. It seems to me one benefit of a yearly conversation.
Peter, thanks for the call. Dr. Welch, what do you think?
Well, I really appreciate Peter's comments, and I should, full disclosure, I'm a primary care physician, so I've done my share of annual checkups. And I say that just so people know where I'm coming from. And I actually agree with Peter. And I think the very question we should be asking is, first, is check up the right word to use? That has the connotation of checking things and looking for things to be wrong. I actually prefer the language of a check-in, because I think that's really what Peter's talking about, a conversation with your doctor that helps establish a relationship. It isn't a concerted effort to look for things to be wrong. It's just a check-in to see how you're doing, what's happening in your life, what kind of things worry you, how do you see your future, how's your family, how's your job, how are your parents, how are your kids. That's the connection that I think is a really valuable part of medical care. Unfortunately, the checkup has become sort of a physical with a lot of testing, a concerted effort to find things wrong. And that's the kind of checkup I'd like to get away from.
Do you see a better system, or in your ideal system, would that yearly check-in not necessarily be with a doctor? I mean, are there ways to set up a medical system where it's not you go to your physician every year, but perhaps there's sort of a better way to have that medical community or healthcare community?
I think that's entirely possible. I don't know that it has to be a doctor, whether it even has to be a nurse practitioner, but you want to be connected to the system with someone who can serve as a shepherd, to sort of shepherd you through the system if and when you need it, particularly, I say, as people age.
Let's go to Jake, who's calling in from New Hampshire. Hi, Jake. Go ahead.
Hi there. My question is, you've been talking a lot about cancer, and my question is, how accurate is a doctor's ability to determine what is a benign tumor and what is a tumor worth acting on?
Yeah, Jake, that's a great question. There's an article this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association showing that pathologists don't agree about who has breast cancer, particularly the early form of breast cancer. So the first question about even who has cancer or not, there's some disagreement among pathologists. And I know that's not a comfortable story to tell, but whether or not you're even told you have cancer, some function of who your pathologist is. And then now we need to understand that everything they label as cancer doesn't mean the same thing that it would to you and I, at least when you first look at a dictionary, where you hear the word cancer means a disease that if you don't do anything, you're going to die from it. Clearly, we now realize that the word has a lot more heterogeneity than that. So there's a lot of uncertainty in exactly what constitutes cancer, particularly when they're small. I mean, this is less of a problem when you have a big cancer. But when you're looking for early forms, all of a sudden the ambiguity becomes much more evident. And I think one of the things we're learning is one of the best pieces of information, and this is a little bit of a outside-of-the-box thinking, although it's happening in lung cancer screening, which is for small things, one of the most important questions is, are they growing? And so before you even put needles in them, you check again. And I think get measurements at 2 points in time. And I think this is for those who want to participate in screening. And as we move forward in screening, we may see more effort to getting another piece of diagnostic information, and that's the diagnostic information afforded by time.
Well, what about something, though, like lung cancer? I mean, obviously, I have a very limited understanding compared to oncologists of cancer, but I always thought lung cancer was one you want to treat that immediately, whereas prostate cancer, you probably want to check to see if that's growing, if you could live with it for many years. But something like lung cancer, I always thought, boy, if you get that early, that's your only chance.
And that's what a lot of people thought until we started screening for it with spiral CT, and we realized a lot more people had lung cancer than we ever thought, including non-smokers. And so now the question becomes, boy, we got to be careful. We're going to be taking out too many lungs and biopsying too often. And so, in fact, the protocol for the current effort to in lung cancer screening for very small abnormalities is not to biopsy them, but wait and follow with a second CT in 3 or 6 months to see whether they're growing. And this is part of our changing understanding of cancer, a growing recognition that the problem of overdiagnosis is not something confined to prostate cancer. It's part of breast cancer. It's part of lung cancer. It's part of melanoma. It's part of thyroid cancer.
While we're on the subject of cancer, Zoe in Burlington emailed in to say, would Dr. Welch please comment on mammography? I'm a 47-year-old woman who's never had a mammogram, and I probably won't. I have no family history, but I get badgered every time I see a health provider, and they all say it's the only tool we have. None seem to be willing to recognize the potential costs of overdiagnosis.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that term badgered, but I'm afraid that is something that happens to more and more women across the country when it comes to mammography. Mammography is a very special part of medicine. It is we call it the third rail of early detection because there's such a vociferous debate about it. The truth of mammography is it probably helps a few women. It definitely leads to overdiagnosis, and the false positive rate in this country is quite frankly inexcusable. In a course of 10 years of screening, roughly half of women will be told at some point there's something abnormal about their breast. From a public health perspective, that's unacceptable for me as a to alarm half the population that something's wrong is just not a good screening test. There is good news in breast cancer screening. It's really important for the public to hear that, and that's the mortality rate from breast cancer is down about 30% over the last 15 years. That's great news. That largely reflects much better treatment, and so people should know that there's no debate that if a woman notices a new breast lump, she should go in and have a diagnostic mammogram. That's not screening. That's simply evaluating what that new lump is.
We're talking with Dr. Gil Welch. He's a professor at Dartmouth Medical School, and his new book is called Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. We're hearing from a lot of you listeners as well. Our number, if you have a question or a story you'd like to share, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also write your thoughts down, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Bill is calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Bill. You're on.
Morning. I have a story that sort of illustrates the doctor's point. A couple years ago, I went in to my primary care physician for the purpose of getting health insurance, or life insurance, I'm sorry. And she did an EKG and found a little blip on the tape. And she said that that indicated that I had already had a heart attack. And not only would that disqualify me from the life insurance, she wanted to put me on medication. I insisted that she show that to a cardiologist who came back with one of the great oxymorons of all time, calling it a normal anomaly. And if I hadn't done that, I would be on medication for the rest of my life. And in fact, I have a normal heart.
Bill, thanks for sharing that anecdote. I appreciate it. I'm going to get another call or two in here while we can, and then Dr. Welch will let you follow up on what we've been hearing. Margaret's on the line with us from Brattleboro. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Margaret, and I'm a cancer patient. I was first diagnosed in early 2005 with breast cancer, but it was ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of cancer that was in a duct in my breast. And I had that, first we had a stereotopic biopsy, and then I had a lumpectomy, and then I had another lumpectomy. And from what I understand about doing surgery on cancer areas is that it can proliferate more cell growth. I'm also a nurse, so it, you know, when you stimulate that area, the cells that want to grow fastest are the cancer ones. So I always kind of felt like maybe if I had not acted immediately on that very early show of cancer, that it may not have spread in the way that it did. Eventually, I had a brain metastasis as well.
Margaret,
anyway,
thanks for sharing those thoughts. I appreciate that. Dr. Welch, is that one of the areas where you see more harm being done than good, even if you're getting treatment for something like cancer?
Well, first I want to say how sorry I am to learn that Margaret has a metastatic disease. Asked for her first question as to whether the initial treatment of ductal carcinoma in situ actually started the process off worse. I don't know the answer to that, and I won't pretend to know the answer to that. I will say, though, that now there are breast cancer surgeons interested in conservative management of ductal carcinoma in situ. I think there's a broad enough recognition now that most of ductal carcinoma in situ will not progress to invasive cancer, that people are beginning to look for more creative approaches and more appropriate approaches to its treatment. By the way, you don't have to deal with the question of ductal carcinoma in situ diagnosis largely if you don't undergo mammography. The only way we find ductal carcinoma in situ is through mammography. And I want to come back to Bill, who had the oxymoron, the normal
anomaly,
which is lovely, and it's perfect, and it does describe a lot of test results that may take a long time to get there, or worse, that something will be done. Something more than simply having your life insurance denied or something because of some question as to whether something's wrong with your heart. And I have actually a very similar story that happened to one of my friends who's an intensive care unit doc up in Anchorage who wanted to get screened for colon cancer, and his primary care physician tried to get a lot of other tests. He wanted to get a chest x-ray, and Bruce said, no, I don't want a chest x-ray. I want to get a get a cholesterol. No, I don't want one. And then she said, at least let me get an EKG. And he didn't want to be a bad patient. He didn't want to be a difficult patient. Okay, you can get an EKG. And it had a normal anomaly. But before that was done, he had had an echo, a cardiac MRI, and now he has a diagnosis of non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is supposed to have absolutely no implication for how he is treated. He's not supposed to be treated any different, but it might be a problem, might not be a problem, and all of a sudden he's nervous about should he continue bike riding, and if he has a sensation in his heart, is this something about his chest? Is it his stomach, or is it his heart? You know, and he wished he'd never started this train because no one suggests doing anything differently. But now he carries this diagnosis and he's a little bit more anxious about it. Some people are suggesting genetic testing so his kids could worry too. It's just a tough situation. And we always assume that it never hurts to get more information. And there are going to be a lot of people selling a lot of tests, particularly genetic tests. I think the whole public needs to be a little bit skeptical about the value of just looking for more data on how you are doing when you are doing well, because I think it's a rapid way to all of a sudden not to feel as well and to lose some of the resilience that really is the essence of health.
That's Dr. Gilbert Welch. He's a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. His new book, the one we've been discussing today, is called Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. Dr. Welch, thank you very much for talking with us again.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll hear from some students in Middlebury whose original research on trapping boats has now become a museum exhibit. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Two Vermont museums are exhibiting the work of some local high school students. Their original research sheds light on a little-known piece of Vermont history. In previous generations, trappers on Lake Champlain sometimes used boats to hunt their quarry. These boats are unique to the region. 13 students, juniors and seniors at the Hannaford Career Center in Middlebury, did this research as part of an engineering class at the Tech Center. And as part of the class, they actually built two full-size replicas of the original trapping boats. I went to the Sheldon Museum in Middlebury to talk with students Riker Billings and Jake Dombeck about their work.
Trappers could actually do most of their work from the shoreline, but some trappers would trap in deeper waters, and they'd need a boat to get to their traps.
Or they'd have to go over deeper waters to get to the location.
Yeah.
Like out by Lake Champlain, there were views all the time.
The trappers would throw actually all of their stuff in the boat, including their traps and their stretching boards, as you can see over there.
Explain what a stretching board is.
So when you skin a muskrat, you turn it inside out over the stretching board so it can dry, and then they would peel them off once they were dry so you could sell them.
What other animals were they trapping?
I guess it depends on the individual. For the most part, the muskrat trapping boats were used for muskrats because they like to hang out near the water.
I think muskrats were the better animal to trap because they were more abundant, and I think the pelts might have been like higher priced or easier to come by.
So this was trapping that was done for the pelts. Is that what they were actually trapping the muskrat for? And then how much would they get, or where would they send them to sell?
Typically, they would send them to brokers, which would then send them typically to Canada. I don't remember how much.
The price fluctuated quite a bit. I think it could have been anywhere from like 15 to like upper 20s for a pelt, like in the good times. Yeah. Yeah, which is pretty good. Because they could get, like, 40 pelts in a day. I think that was, like, one of the trappers told us that was the most they got, or something like that.
So how did you learn about these trapping boats? And then we're going to talk a little bit about the one that you built. But how did you do the research to find out about this history?
Most of our research was through interviews, actually, because there's not much documentation of any of this. So what we were doing, we were pretty much finding out, like, new information that no one had found before, so that was pretty cool.
So tell me about one, and I assume these were men that you were talking to. Tell me about one of the guys that you talked to.
Barry Forbes. He was kind of like a gruff on the outside, but actually really kind-hearted, I found him to be, which was funny. And he still traps today, and he traps many things besides muskrats, bobcats.
He makes a living off of trapping. So a specific story would actually have to be the Bud Smith going to his camp. It was really interesting because how they had a dozen people in this tiny little room staying weeks at a time. And there's a water there, so they went out every morning and checked their traps, went back to the camp, and then checked it again in the evening.
And where was this? Just off Lake Champlain, you say? But what town?
Addison.
So as part of this class, not only did you learn about this history and get to interview people who had actually been involved in it, but you built a full-scale replica of a trapping boat. And let's look at it. Come over here and tell me about it. And you're going to have to describe it because obviously the radio audience can't see it. So tell us first what it looks like.
Well, it's a shallow, it's not very flat bottom, not very tall. It's very basic. It's not really anything special.
How can you say that? You spent all of this blood, sweat, and tears building it.
If you look compared to other boats that are on that, when you think about boats, it's nothing compared to that. It's really ordinary.
Yeah, I'm guessing you mean, you know, it's just this sort of plain utilitarian wooden boat.
Yeah, it has the pretty much the bare minimum that a trapper would need.
So if we were out trapping, Jake, explain what else would be in this boat.
Well, you can see in the other boat the long pole, which they would use to push the boat along because they'd mostly be in shallow enough water to use that. And also for deeper water, there's oar locks here.
And just one seat.
Yeah, just one seat. It was manned by one person typically.
Would there be other people in the boat usually, or did they go out by themselves?
Went out by themselves. And actually, there's a gun hook. You can see it on the old boat. They'd carry their gun in case they encountered any game while they were out.
So you guys and your class built this boat. Did you have any boat building experience before you took this class?
I had none. Douglas taught us a lot.
Did you enjoy it?
I did, actually. Many different techniques were taught to us. Some traditional Japanese styles we used, because that's what Douglas specializes in. So that was cool to learn those and apply it to this project.
When you look at this boat now, do you look at specific boards and think, yeah, I put that one in?
Yeah, because this is one of the boats I worked on. I worked on a lot of the bottom planking. I could tell you what side I actually worked on.
Yeah, I want to see. Which one?
I worked on primarily, if it flipped over, it would be that side.
Why did you paint the boat red?
I think it was just a class decision. We decided to paint the boats that we made red.
I think this one used to be red, so we were trying to...
And by this one, you mean there's an old boat right next to the one that you built. This is an old original trapping boat. And yes, you said this is red, although it's kind of like an old barn. You can sort of tell it's red, but...
Yeah. And it's also wrapped in tin on the bottom. That was used to break the ice in colder months, I guess.
But yours, you didn't wrap in tin.
No, we kind of ran out of time at the end of our project, so we didn't have time to wrap in tin.
That was Riker Billings and Jake Dombeck, two students who worked on the Trapping Boats project. The students' instructors were standing in the doorway while we talked, Jake Burnham, the engineering instructor, and Douglas Brooks, the boat builder they worked with. So I asked the teachers why they had students in an engineering class build boats. Burnham said this was part of the computer-aided design, or CAD, program that's been evolving in recent years.
Traditionally, Vermont's CTE centers, the engineering programs, are a CAD program. And over the past several years, we've been trying to evolve our program to be more of an in-depth investigation into engineering careers. So the boat project, from my perspective, fit in nicely with a naval architecture potential career path. I'm not sure if the students really saw that long-term connection, but from a curriculum standpoint, it fit in really, really well. It took up quite a bit more time in the fall than we would have traditionally spent on naval architecture, but I think every ounce of it was worth it. Just the social experience, the interviewing the trappers, as both Jake and Riker said, this is an era of time that won't really be repeating itself, given today's technology and how fast we move and the lack of muskrats.
So what is the value of what these students have accomplished?
Well, I'm incredibly excited about the CAD drawings because these represent the drawings the students did of three historic boats represents the first thorough documentation of a vernacular Lake Champlain boat. No other institution has done that before this high school class. So for me, the cultural preservation is really important. And the exhibit itself just goes beyond that and puts that in a fuller perspective with label copy, real artifacts, the replica boat, and the boat drawings. And I look ahead and think with the drawings, we can move toward trying to encourage people to build these boats. Not necessarily for trapping, but just for a recreational boat. Because I'd like to think that if somebody's out there and they'd like to try building a boat, this is a perfect boat to do it. It's a perfect beginner boat. And why not build something that is intimately connected with our region? So I think of it in terms of ecology, reintroducing a species. You know, let's reintroduce a traditional Lake Champlain boat. So, you know, who knows where we could go from here? Workshops, a how-to book, any number of things, but it'll all grow from this original research that the students did.
This type of work is what our career centers do every day. this particular project happens to be about trapping boats of Lake Champlain. But you could go across to the Upper Valley. Riverbend Tech Center is going to be doing something original there. You know, we were very fortunate that Douglas is in our backyard, so to speak, and he thought of us when this project came to him. So people would be very surprised that this was original work done by high school students if they knew more about what we in the tech centers are capable of. They would expect it.
Jake Burnham and Douglas Brooks talking about the work their students did on the history of trapping boats on Lake Champlain. The class will be launching one of their replica boats in Otter Creek in Middlebury on Saturday, April 18th. You can see the exhibit at the Henry Sheldon Museum in Middlebury. There's also another exhibit about the history of trapping boats on Lake Champlain at the Frog Hollow Gallery in Burlington. And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, we'll look at how cuts in transportation funding will affect Vermont. After several years of putting more money into road and bridge improvements, the state is looking at having less money, perhaps significantly less money, to keep them in good shape. We'll talk with the heads of the legislature's transportation committees about the impact that will have. And you can send your questions or comments or photos of bad roads to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Steve Zind, with production assistance from Devin Karambolis. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.